probably forgot to tell you, Florence, my wife's here this weekend. Well, good afternoon. My name is Jack, and I am an alcoholic. And when I saw Beth rushing up to the podium, I thought, at last, the speaker's here. I can get off of here, you know. The real speaker showed up. I'm from Hagerstown, Maryland, and I am a member of the cleverly named Hagerstown Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our group is the third oldest group in the state of Maryland, and come September we're going to celebrate 60 years. Yeah, they deserve that. And I like to consider myself to be a member of good standing of that group, and by that I mean I have a sponsor, and my sponsor has a sponsor, and I sponsor people, and I have a service commitment to that group. I am the current GSR, and we didn't know that this thing was going to catch on 60 years ago, so we didn't name ourselves the Golden Slippers or anything like that. We're just the Hagerstown Group. We meet on Mondays, Thursdays, and Saturdays in Hagerstown, and if you're ever there, we're not that hard to find, and we'd love to have you come visit with us. We have heard five really terrific speakers so far in this convention, and starting this evening, you're going to hear five more really terrific speakers. And I'm kind of the baloney sandwiched in between what you have heard and what you're going to hear. I want to thank the committee for allowing Tommy to invite me to come here. I don't see Tommy in the room, but I think it's very important that you know who's responsible for my being here, and it is Tommy, because if I say anything in the next 2.5 hours that we're together that offends you, I want you to take that up with Tommy, because I don't want to hear about it. But if I do say something you like, by all means, please tell me after the meeting, because I just love those attaboys. I really do. I'm going to put my watch up here, not because I can actually see it or pay too much attention to it, but I think it gives hope to the newcomer, and I'll put it up there. Let me ask you this afternoon here among us, could you raise your hand if you're in your first 7 or 8 months of recovery? Could I see the hands of you? Oh, great. This is great. Wonderful. Wonderful. Thank you very much for coming. And welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. That is where you are, you know. And, yeah, it has come to this. It really has. And, indeed, we already know an awful lot about you. Like, for instance, we really know that 2006 has been a lousy year. But now you're in AA, and that's a good thing. That is a good thing. And I would hope that if indeed you are new here, or if you're coming back, that you'll stay here. Because one of the things that I have found in Alcoholics Anonymous has been is there's absolutely nothing, and I mean nothing here, that will harm me. And there's nothing here that will cause me any pain. Any pain that I have experienced in Alcoholics Anonymous has been a direct result of my resistance to the program of recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous, and not as a result of the program itself. It's just, you know, me being a knucklehead. So stay here, enjoy it. It's going to be a great time. You're going to love it. Joe, I'm going to need an extra copy of this lead, if you would, tape, because my guy Mike, he doesn't have a CD player, but he does have a tape player. And I talked to him earlier today, and he's supposed to call me, but he doesn't call me like he's supposed to. So then I call him, and then he acts as like it's a big surprise, and where are you, Jack? And I said, well, I'm down in Florida. And, yeah, I remember now. And he said, would you bring me a copy of that lead, and of your lead? And I said, well, sure, Mike, if you want me to. He said, yeah, I'd really like that. And I said, well, sure, I'll do that. And I got to be perfectly honest with you folks. I haven't got the slightest idea what Mike's going to do with that lead because he doesn't pay attention to a word I say when he's sitting right across from me. So what the heck he's going to do with it, I don't know. But Joe, I'd appreciate that. I want to thank Dave here to my left, your right. Dave has been hosting us since we got here, and believe me, he's been doing yeoman service. And I, for one, really appreciate it, and I hope it doesn't stop with this speech. I mean, I hope you keep on to Sunday. But Ann and I very much appreciate it, Dave. Thank you so much. My mom is 91 years old, and before I left to come down here, I, of course, called her and cleared the trip with her. And she was married to my alcoholic father for 30 years, and she knows what an alcoholic is. And she is astounded that I get invited to come to these things. She really is. Because she tells me, she says, Jack, you're not an alcoholic. And I want to believe my mom. I want to listen to her. I think it's about time I started listening to her. And she might be on to something. I think I may have overreacted to this whole thing. I don't know. Back when I was 14 years old, my mom and I have a younger sister, they were out for the evening. My dad and I were home, and he was trying to get me to do something that I didn't want to do. And I know it's going to be hard for some of you to believe that I was a little bit headstrong and bullheaded when I was a teenager. And so I was being very resistant to what he wanted me to do, and he entered into a period of negotiations with me. And as part of those negotiations, he said, look, son, I'll do anything you want me to do if you'll do this thing for me. And I said, okay, I'll make that deal. And he said, what do you want me to do? And I said, I'd like you to quit drinking. He said, well, your mom's been after me to quit drinking. And I know it's been causing some trouble here at home. And I know we're having difficulties down at the store, and probably some of that's associated with my drinking, so... All right, I'll quit drinking. Now, I'll tell you, this was an answer to prayer. You know, there really is a God. I had been praying that God would help my father stop drinking. I know my mom had been praying that he would stop drinking. Pretty sure my sister had been praying that he'd stop drinking. And so when mom and my sister got home that night, I met them at the door, and I told them our problems are over. Dad and I have had a talk, and he's agreed to stop drinking. And joy reigned supreme in our house that night. And the next morning, my dad got drunk. And that's the day I closed the door on God. Because I didn't want to have anything to do with a God who would play fast and loose with the prayers of my family like that. And I certainly didn't want to have anything to do with a God like that, who obviously found me to be unworthy and found my prayers to be unworthy. And it became readily apparent to me that if I was going to do anything in this life, and if I was going to be anything in this life, and if I was ever going to accomplish anything in this life, I was going to have to do it on my own, all by myself. And so I began to worship at that altar of self-sufficiency. And I'd like to tell you that drinking came, I guess, a year or so later. And I think drinking probably did for me what it did for most of you in this room who are alcoholic. It's that, what's the big book say, that sense of ease and comfort that comes from a few drinks? That ability to fit in, the shyness falls away. When I was not drinking, I really wasn't very sociable. But drinking, I could talk to people, and I could talk to girls. I could dance. I thought I could sing. I heard a lady from a podium not too long ago said that when she drank, her pimples fell off and her boobs got big. Well, I didn't have the boob experience, but I did have the pimple experience. And where has this stuff been all my life? I mean, this is good stuff. This is the answer. I'm sorry my dad has such a problem drinking. It's too bad he can't hold his booze. But hey, I'm the last man standing. You know, I'm the guy that drives everybody else home. This is a pretty prominent social thing, and it seemed like a good thing at the time. Little did I know that it was a symptom of a fatal disease. Now, I'd like to tell you that in high school that alcohol didn't cause me any problem, but I do need to tell you that I spent 5 years in high school. I like to say it's because I wanted to have a strong academic base before I went off to college. But in truth, alcohol had a lot to do with my being kept back a year. And when I got out of high school, I went to the community college, and guys were just starting to come back from Nam, and those guys drank like I drank, and I fell right in with them. And then I went down to the University of Maryland. At the University of Maryland, I joined a fraternity, and I'd like to tell you it was an academic fraternity, but it wasn't. And I had a great time at the University of Maryland drinking my way through there. And I guess it was before I went to the University of Maryland, while I was still in the community college, my best friend and I had decided that we were going to take a road trip and we were going to go to California. And we had each packed an overnight bag and we'd gotten 12 cases of beer and put them in my car. And I had quit my job, and I had a pocket full of money, and we had everything you needed to go to California. But the night before we were to leave, my friend's father told him he couldn't go. And so here I am with 12 cases of beer and a pocket full of money and no job. And what's a guy going to do? And as some of you know, the state of Maryland has a little sliver of its eastern border on the Atlantic Ocean, and we have a town there called Ocean City. And so I went down to Ocean City, and I spent the month of August there drinking those 12 cases of beer, eating leftover restaurant food, and staying in the basement of hotels where I had friends who were working as bellhops and desk clerks. And so I didn't have to spend any money on room or board. And when I ran out of beer, I had that money to buy the beer. Some of you may have missed the announcement that Beth made about cell phones. And I've got an announcement of my own, because I know alcoholics don't like being told what to do, and we generally do the opposite. So if you've got a cell phone with you this afternoon, by all means, turn that cell phone on. If you're expecting a liver transplant. But if you're not, maybe you could put it on vibrate, and that way you could enjoy your incoming call, and you wouldn't disturb the rest of us. I'm down in Ocean City, and I'm a keen observer of the social scene, and I've decided I want to work in Ocean City next summer. But here's what I observed. If you were a lifeguard, a beach boy, a bartender, a waiter, a waitress, it didn't make any difference. If you drank and acted like I drank and acted, sometime during the summer, you were likely to get locked up. But I saw there was a group of people who were not getting arrested in Ocean City, and that were members of the Ocean City Police Department. So I became an Ocean City policeman the following year. Now, they gave me a boardwalk beat. It was Ninth Street. It was prime territory right outside the beach club. I'd been there maybe 7 days when it became apparent that I possess a very unique talent. I can spot an underage drinker from 100 yards. And when I approached that person and established that he or she were underage, I would then ask if I could look in the cooler. What's in the cooler? Just Coca-Cola and tuna fish, officer. Well, let's open it up and take a look. And there, of course, laid across the top in beautiful rows would be the Coca-Cola with the ice and the little tuna fish and a loaf of bread. But I'd reach way down into the bottom of that cooler, and you know I would come up with a Budweiser. And then everything changed. Because, you see, your life is over. Oh, I know, you think you're going to college, but you're not. You're going to jail. You're a minor in possession of alcohol, and we frown upon that here in Ocean City, and you're going to jail. Oh, you thought you were going to the military? I'm sorry about that, but it ain't happening for you. You're going to jail, and the military's not going to have anything to do with you. In fact, I'm going to call your mom and dad at 3 a.m. this morning, and I'm going to tell them where you are in the Ocean City Jail, and they're going to have to drive all the way down here to get you. You want to offer an alternative to that? What'd you have in mind? Confiscate the beer? Well, that is an alternative, but if I took the beer, I'm going to have to take the cooler, and if I take the cooler, I'm going to take the Coke and the tuna fish. Well, okay, if that's what you want to do, now I'm going to put your name right down here in my official police log, and don't you ever, ever do this again in Ocean City. Now, it's really hard to walk a beat as a beat patrolman dragging a cooler full of beer behind you. So I worked out a deal with my lieutenant and sergeant that I would call them and they would come with their squad car and they would pick up the coolers as I accumulated them. And then at the end of my shift, I would give them the wine and the whiskey and I got to keep the coolers and the beer and the tuna fish. And we had a great summer. It was a wonderful summer. I didn't buy anything to drink the whole summer. I drank every day and I didn't get arrested. And that's my definition of a good summer. I had such a good summer that I went back for a second summer. And the second summer, they gave me a squad car of my very own. It was one of those Crown Victorias, you know. I mean, you can put six coolers in the trunk of that puppy with no problem whatsoever. And same deal, however, with my lieutenant and sergeant. They still got the wine and the whiskey, and I kept the cooler and the beer and the tuna fish. Had another good summer, drank all summer, didn't buy anything to drink, did not get arrested. So why not go back for a third summer? Now, this event that I'm about to tell you about occurred during that third summer. I was on the beach highway about 3 o'clock in the morning. There was a car obviously being driven by a drunk driver. I made the traffic stop, got the guy out of the car. I'm writing up his ticket. He looks at me and he says, "You don't know who I am, do you, officer?" I said, "No, I don't." He said, "Well, I am the state's attorney for Worcester County, the county you're standing in right now." Well, I'm a college kid. I don't know what a state's attorney is. Never heard of a state's attorney. I said, "Well, good for you. Sign the ticket." So he signed a ticket, and there was a fellow there who was sober, so I let him drive, and they went on their way. And at 8 o'clock in the morning when my shift ended, I pulled into the Ocean City Police Department, and there in the parking lot was the chief of police. And he said to me, "Quarterman," he says, "come up to my office and bring that uniform citation book with you." I thought, this is a good thing. These are the first words the chief has spoken to me all summer. I'm about to get recognition for a job well done. Long overdue recognition, I might add. So I go up there with my ticket book, and I get in the office, and there, right inside the door, seated on the couch, is the guy I gave the ticket to at 3 o'clock in the morning. So, gave the ticket book to the chief. Chief flips it open, gives the ticket book to the guy on the couch. Guy on the couch pulls out a pen, writes across the face of the ticket, "Case dismissed." It was at that moment I decided I wanted to be a lawyer. And if I could become one of those state's attorneys, it was going to be very handy. Because if you drank and drove like I drank and drove, the ability to dismiss traffic charges with the stroke of a pen was going to come in really handy. Really handy. So I went to law school. While in law school, I got married, and after law school, I moved. My hometown was Hagerstown. My wife and I moved back to Hagerstown, and I don't think we'd been there more than a few weeks, and I became aware that there was a vacancy in the state's attorney's office for an assistant state's attorney. So I went right over there and, you know, said, "Here I am. The answer to your prayers, when do you want me to start?" Now, as I've already heard from this podium so far in the last couple of days, many of us seem to share a hearing problem. That is, we hear things differently. And so what I'm about to tell you is what I heard them say. Not necessarily what they said, but what I thought I heard them say. And what I thought I heard them say went something like this. What? You some kind of idiot? You just got out of law school. You've never been in a courtroom. You've never picked a jury. You've never interviewed a witness. You've never cross-examined anybody. Get out of here. That's what I thought I heard them say. Now, in reality, I believe they said that the position had been filled. But I heard what I heard, and my feelings were hurt. And I was upset. And having been in Alcoholics Anonymous now for a while, I understand I left there with a resentment. And an alcoholic with a resentment can do a lot. And in our community, very much I'm sure like your community, we elect our state's attorneys. So I went off and found myself a lawyer who wanted to be state's attorney. I ran his campaign for state's attorney. He got elected state's attorney, and he made me deputy state's attorney. I got in that office and discovered that we didn't have any badges. And there's no point in being a state's attorney if you don't have a badge. So I designed a very fine badge for the state's attorney's office. And when you get a badge, you get a badge case. And in that badge case, they have a clear plastic thing where you put your driver's license. And when they pull you over and they ask to see that license and registration, and you open up that badge case and exhibit it to them, they don't want to see that driver's license. They want to see the badge. Oh, the badge, officer? Deputy State's Attorney, Washington County. Yes, sir, I understand. Yes, I'll hold it down. Yeah, yeah. I don't have that far to go, really. Well, thank you, sir. I really appreciate it. No. No offense, sir. No, I understand. You're just doing your job. I appreciate the professional courtesy. Thank you. You have a nice evening, too. Now, some of you may be getting a little insight into why I don't have any arrests or drunk driving charges in my past. But it gets better. My boss, the state's attorney, was supposed to become a circuit court judge. Governor said they were going to appoint him on Monday. And if he got appointed on Monday, I was going to get to be the state's attorney. And I don't know how it is here in Florida, but certainly back in Maryland sometimes, the state senator sticks his nose in where it doesn't belong, and he screws it all up. And that's what happened. And somebody else got appointed circuit court judge. I was upset. Not so much that my friend didn't get to be circuit court judge, but I was very angry that I didn't get to be state's attorney. I knew now that I had a resentment. And so one night, while sitting around having a few adult beverages with some like-minded drinkers, we concluded that somebody had to show that state senator they just couldn't be cavalier like that. Somebody ought to run against that state senator. So I ran for the state senate, and I didn't know that the state senator was going to abandon his wife and children and run off with the secretary of the Appropriations Committee and move to Florida, but he did, and I got elected state senator. Now, in Maryland, if you're elected state senator, they give you a license plate. And that license plate says, State Senator. Now, this is an aid to efficient law enforcement. Because when they come up behind you on the interstate, and they got those overheads going, and they get close enough to see that license plate, they turn those overheads off. They come up alongside you, they turn that interior dome light on, and they toot the horn. Hi, Senator. Hi, Trooper. Hold it down, Senator. Okay, Trooper. And that way you don't have state police on the side of the highway messing with members of the General Assembly when they could be out arresting real criminals. Well, I'd like to tell you about my legislative career, but in Annapolis, our state capital, very much like your state capital, Tallahassee, we have a group of people whose sole function in life is to see to it that any member of the General Assembly can have a drink of beverage alcohol on any day at any hour he or she so desires. These people are called lobbyists. I had many friends among the lobbying corps in Maryland, so anything that I would tell you about my legislative career would be purely hearsay. And I don't like to spread rumors. But I do know this, that guy that got appointed circuit court judge, he didn't like being circuit court judge. He quit. I went over to the governor and said, "Governor, as the state senator, I'd like you to appoint my friend the state's attorney circuit court judge." And the governor said, "No, we're not doing that." He said, "I'm still upset about that last dust-up we had up there in Washington County. I won't be appointing him. However, if you'd like to be circuit court judge, I'll make you circuit court judge." Well, it's a 15-year term, and we only had two of them in our community, so it only comes around every now and then. So I became a circuit court judge. Now, keep in mind, I'm drinking alcoholically all through this. And I love drinking. Absolutely adored drinking. I loved everything about drinking. I like those Tom Collins, those tall, slim, frosted glasses. I like those that stemware for the martini. Like those old-fashioned glasses. The appropriate glass for the appropriate drink. Very big on that. I like that. I like top shelf stuff. I like imported stuff. I liked wine. Although I must admit I prefer twist off tops to cork because they're just really hard to get out. And I didn't have a lot of time. But if you came up to me with a brown paper bag and you stuck it out and said, "Jack, take a pull on this," I would never think to ask you what it is. I'd take a pull on it. Pooh! That's good stuff. Whew! Because you wouldn't offer it to me if it wasn't good stuff. I know that. You know how when you have a barbecue there at the house or a cocktail party or you have guys in to play poker and you're cleaning up the next day and there are beer cans all around the place and you're picking them up and, "Oh, this has got a little something in it." Pooh! What was that? Oh, cigarette butt. Oh, yeah, there's some cigarette butt drinkers in here. Yeah. Yes, indeed. We are an experienced crowd. So, give you some idea of my cooperation with the Bar Association as circuit court judge. They were having a continuing legal education program on the prosecution and defense of drunk driving. And Sergeant Long was going to be there with his breathalyzer, and they needed a volunteer to drink the beer. Somebody who was impartial, unbiased, fair-minded. So they're bringing out they brought out a tray that had six cans of beer in it, all iced down really nice, looked really great. I said to the guy, I said, "What's that?" He said, "That's the beer for tonight's program." I said, "You do realize that this is a two-hour program." Yes, indeed. We are an experienced crowd. So, give you some idea of my cooperation with the Bar Association as circuit court judge. They were having a continuing legal education program on the prosecution and defense of drunk driving. And Sergeant Long was going to be there with his breathalyzer, and they needed a volunteer to drink the beer. Somebody who was impartial, unbiased, fair-minded. So they're bringing out they brought out a tray that had six cans of beer in it, all iced down really nice, looked really great. I said to the guy, I said, "What's that?" He said, "That's the beer for tonight's program." I said, "You do realize that this is a two-hour program, and you've only brought out six beers." He said, "Oh, we got plenty back in the back." I said, "Well, you go ice it down and bring it out, because I'm not drinking any warm beer." And so they began, and, you know, the prosecutor began, and I commenced to drinking, and every 15 minutes I blow into the breathalyzer, and, you know, you kind of get started with a .04 and move it up to a .07 and a .11, .15 and a .18 and then a .20, and I'm drinking, they're talking, .23, .27, .29, .30, .33, and then they called upon me to put on my part of the program, which I'm told was quite good under the circumstance. And after the program was over, I said to the chairman, I said, "Who's going to drive me home?" And he said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, I just blew a .33 in Sergeant Long's breathalyzer here. I can't go out and get in the car and drive home." He said, "We never thought about that." I said, "Well, I'll tell you what." I said, "I'm going to go in the bar and have a couple drinks, and you come get me when Sergeant Long's gone." And so I did, and they did, and Sergeant Long left, and I got in my car, and I drove down to the Broad Axe, and I had a couple drinks down there, and then I went over to the cellar door, and I had a couple drinks over there, and then I went home, and that was just a night of social drinking for the judge. And I think I need to also tell you that Alcoholics Anonymous in my community, under my leadership as circuit court judge, enjoyed a tremendous membership growth. Attendance went way up. New members came in like in droves, because as a circuit court judge, I knew what to do with alcoholics. Remember, my dad was an alcoholic, and I knew what to do with people like you. And so the membership was swelling in Washington County. And I went out on one occasion to have dinner. Really, that was the stated purpose. That's what I told my wife. Irv and I were going out to have dinner. But Irv and I both knew that we were going out to get snot flying drunk. I mean, that's what we were going to do. I mean, drunk. I mean, you know how you, drunk. I mean, sometimes you can get drunk by accident. We were going out to get drunk deliberately. And we did a heck of a job of it, too. And we ended up in a local bar that night. And had I known that this was going to be my last drink of beverage alcohol, I want to assure all of you I would have ordered something else. Because I've told you I really love drinking. And I had a love affair with Jack Daniel's Black on crushed ice with a twist of lemon. I mean, that's to die for. I was also very, very fond of the gin martini. Very fond of the gin martini. But I had a bad gin experience on one occasion, and even to this day, it's hard for me to go into a pine forest. But but on this occasion, I ordered a Tia Maria. I know. Well, how do you think I feel standing up here? It's embarrassing. I know there are people in here right now. What the heck is that? In my own defense, I'm pretty sure it was a tainted bottle. And the reason I think that is, on the way home that night, I threw up. Now, I know throwing up is part of drinking. I know that. I mean, like, if you're down at the Broad Axe shooting pool, 10, 11 o'clock at night, and you're getting a little full, you go out behind a dumpster and you throw up. And you come back out and back in and you shoot pool. I understand. Throwing up's part of drinking. Saturday morning, on my knees, worshiping at that porcelain altar that we all have in our homes, resting my head on that toilet. I understand. Saturday morning, throwing up. That is part of drinking. I work on Friday, and so I was home with the flu. I had that upset stomach that comes with the flu. And Saturday, I started to develop that lower tract distress that comes with flu frequently. And if you got that lower tract distress combined with that upset stomach thing, that'll hone your decision making down to a fine point, because you don't know whether to sit or kneel or kneel or sit. And at least one occasion that weekend, my wife tells me I made the wrong decision. You want to talk to her about that after the meeting, you're free to do so, but I'm moving on. Easter Sunday, I was feeling a little bit better, but by Monday, I was really dehydrated from all that kneeling and sitting that I've been doing. And so they took me to the hospital, and they admitted me, and that night my abdomen became distended, and they did an emergency laparotomy on me, and they found my abdomen was full of peritonitis, gangrene. And while they were trying to clean that mess up, my kidneys quit, my liver was enlarged, and my pancreas was digesting itself, and my respiratory system quit. So things were not looking good for the home team. And I spent 3 weeks in intensive care in the Hagerstown Hospital, and my condition was getting worse. They did get me off the respirator, but everything else was still not functioning right. And eventually, the determination was made to send me to Johns Hopkins Hospital. Now, I was encouraged by this because I had known people who had gone to Johns Hopkins, and they had come home. They had lived. And I knew people who had gone to the Washington County Hospital, and they had died. So, sounded good to me, but they told my wife that they didn't know anything else that they could do for me in Washington County, and they doubted seriously that I was going to survive at Johns Hopkins. And that, in point of fact, they were sending me down there to die, but if I had any chance at all of survival, it would have to be there. I would have found that discouraging if they had told me that. So I went down to Johns Hopkins, and for 2 weeks they did everything down there except hang me by my thumbs. I was presented to the internal medicine department. They could not get a majority vote on what was wrong with me. They performed all of these tests, and finally, my belly button birthday is on May the 14th. And on May the 13th, the night of May the 13th, I couldn't take it anymore. And so that night, these physicians who were so good to me and working so hard to save my life came into my room, and they said that... Well, before they got to say anything, I told them, I can't take it anymore. You got to give me a day of rest. Tomorrow's my birthday. And they said, well, Judge, that's why we came in here. Just we don't know what to do for you. We tried everything. We don't know what you have, and we don't know what to do. So we're going to give you a day of rest tomorrow. And my wife went over to a stationery store and bought a form real estate lease. And she wrote out a lease between God and me. And she gave it to me for my birthday. She said that I had a new lease on life. That life, in fact, began at 40. And I passed my 40th birthday in the Johns Hopkins Hospital. And 2 weeks later, on May the 28th, I was discharged from the Johns Hopkins Hospital. My kidney function came back. My pancreas stopped digesting itself. My liver function was becoming normal. And when you're in a hospital for 7 weeks like that, when they let you go, they want to talk to you about what you should do or what you shouldn't do so that you don't come back anymore. But since I had this undiagnosed illness, they really didn't know what to tell me. They just suggested that I not get it again, because if I did, it might kill me. Now, personally, I have always maintained that it's a lot better to survive an undiagnosed illness than to die of a known cause. As I was getting just ready to walk out of the office of those physicians, one of them said to me, they asked me the strangest question. This one doctor said, Judge, we got one more question. Do you drink? Huh? Do you drink? Well, I'm a lawyer. Well, I was a lawyer, now I'm a judge. As a lawyer, I had to drink with clients. I had to drink with other lawyers. I had to drink with judges. Sure, I drank. As a judge, I have to drink with lawyers. And I got to drink with other judges. I mean, it's an occupational thing. You know, it's a commitment, professional commitment. Well, how much do you drink? Not very much. Why? Well, we would like you to not drink for a while. How long? A year. Who? A year. Well, I haven't had a drink since April the 7th. This is May 28th. All right, I think I can do that. I'll do that. No, no, Judge, you don't understand. This is Memorial Day weekend. We want you to not drink from June the 1st. Now, I'm pretty sure there are people in this room who've already discerned the injustice that these doctors were trying to perpetuate upon me because I was getting no credit for my 7 weeks of continuous sobriety. I want you to know that I fought for those 7 weeks, and we ended up with a compromise. And the compromise was I would not drink until April the 7th of the following year. And then, if I thought drinking had anything to do with the pain, suffering, and misery that I'd undergone for the past 7 weeks, then I could choose not to drink for another 7 weeks till June the 1st. And I walked out of the Johns Hopkins Hospital, and I walked into the most insane period of my life. Not drinking and not changing. You know, the big book says that we who are alcoholic, when alcohol is removed, we become restless, irritable, and discontent. That is a gross understatement in my case. I don't know about your case, but in my case, it was a gross understatement. My wife and I, when I was drinking, were separated 3 times. And after I stopped drinking, we were separated 3 times. Now, I think that's pretty clear evidence that drinking had nothing to do with those separations. But alcoholism had everything to do with those separations. Let me back up a second. You know, when I was talking about fighting for those 7 weeks of sobriety, when I talk to people who are not alcoholic about that, they don't laugh. They look at me like I'm crazy. And, of course, I am crazy. I mean, that's why part of the reason why I was invited to be here. I am here because I'm not all there. But it really calls into question your sanity. Since you're sitting in here on a Friday afternoon listening to me. But I digress. I got untreated alcoholism and I don't know it. I don't know it. And the insanity of my life is just beginning. I ought to say this because... If I don't screw this thing up, Ann and I are going to be married 40 years come August 20th. Honey, stand up so they can see you're real. You're probably going to want to give her a chip by the time I get finished with this talk. The insanity of not drinking and not changing. I mean, it's just horrible. And I think everybody in here who's tried to quit drinking on their own knows exactly what I mean. Because for people like us, drinking is our medicine. It's what makes life tolerable. You know, this restless irritability and discontentment comes upon me. I either pick up a drink... slow suicide, or I pick up a gun, fast suicide. And I'm not drinking and I'm not changing, and my life is spinning out of control unbelievably. And I'm a circuit court judge, and I'm being paid big money to solve your problems, and I can't solve mine. And I didn't know what to do. 2 members of Alcoholics Anonymous, Ken and Bob, faithful, stalwart members of Alcoholics Anonymous, were watching me die of untreated alcoholism. Bob, who, let me back up and say this. My dad, on July 3rd, 1968, was walking by a Methodist church in Hagerstown. The pastor put on the message board, "Don't buy a fifth on the third for the fourth." My dad went to Alcoholics Anonymous that night, and he never drank again. And he died with 15 years of continuous sobriety in this program. And I carry his 15-year medallion with me. And I hope in some small way I can help repay the debt that I owe to Alcoholics Anonymous for my dad's sobriety. He had 15 wonderful years in this program. Before he quit drinking, he lost everything that of value in his life, the material as well as the immaterial. And he lost that business that he had tried to build for almost 20 years. He lost his 30-year marriage to my mom. He lost the respect of his son, me, and my sister, Sue. When she got married, I gave her away because she did not invite our father to the wedding because she was afraid he would show up drunk. And he did show up, and he was drunk. And Alcoholics Anonymous gave him back his dignity, gave him back his self-respect, gave him back his integrity. Man, I owe a lot to Alcoholics Anonymous for that. And Bob came to me and he said, "Jack," he said, "we have this book in Alcoholics Anonymous called The Big Book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and maybe you'd like to read it and find out about your dad's illness." Clever guy, that Bob. I think you know as well as I do, if Bob had said, "Jack, we'd like you to read this book so you can find out what's wrong with you," I wouldn't have read the book, because there's nothing wrong with me. I'm not drinking, and I haven't been drinking for a long time. And everybody knows that alcoholics have to drink. Therefore, if you're not drinking, you are not alcoholic. Okay? You got that? Leave me alone. Mind your own darn business, okay? Get out of my face, all right? Just, okay, I'm a little prickly, all right? I'm just a little prickly, but leave me alone. I'm fine. I'm fine. So I read that book, and much to my surprise, there's a place in there that says, "Many of us at an early age close the door on God." You know that little story I told you at the beginning when I was 14 years old? I thought I was the only person who had closed the door on God at an early age. How could they put something like that in a book that was written before I was born? How could they know? And then there's a place in there where Bill's in the bar. He's going to just get a ginger ale and then whiskey rising to his head. He's pounding on the bar. "How did this happen to me again? Oh, well, I just may as well stay here and get good and bombed," something like that. How many times did I go into the Broad Axe fully intending not to have anything to drink? All right, well, maybe I'll have one. No more than two. Because I'd said I'd be home 5:30, no later than 6. And now it's 8 o'clock. And the crowd in the bar is changing, and I'm still sitting there. And I'm on my 7th or my 8th or my 9th, and I can't go home now. They've already had dinner. She's putting the kids to bed. I go home now, there's going to be a big row. I may as well just stay here till closing. How many times did that happen? Well, I'd like to say it only happened once or twice, but the reality is it happened 4 or 5 times a week. Week in and week out, month in to month out for a number of years. And I never saw it. Now, our big book says that the alcoholic is driven by 100 forms of self-delusion. It doesn't say anything about denial. Denial is a treatment center word. Florence turns her head away. I steal her wallet. She looks back and says, "Jack, do you have my wallet?" "I got it right here, baby. But I ain't telling. I'm not giving it up. I know the truth, but I'm not giving it up. That's denial. Delusion is when I tell myself a lie and I believe it to be true. Florence says, you got my wallet? I say, no. I don't know what this thing is in my pocket, but I'm not going to look. Because I didn't take your wallet. And I believe that to be true, even though I'm sitting on her wallet. Delusional thinking. I cannot differentiate the true from the false. I have an alcoholic mind. So Ken and Bob, they would come over on Fridays at lunchtime to my chambers. That's a fancy word for judge's office. Every Friday they came to my judge's office and they brought their big books, and I had a big book and a brown bag lunch. And we would sit together and we would read the big book. And Bob and Ken would explain to me the importance of what they had read. And then I would explain to them the importance of what they had read. And we had some very stimulating intellectual discussions about the meaning of what we had read. Now, you see, I am a very smart person. You need to know that. If you haven't caught on to that yet, I am really quite smart. Look, there goes a hunchback. I'm a very smart guy. And I explained to Ken and Bob, I'll admit I was 5 years in high school, but I got out of undergraduate school in 4 years. I graduated from law school with honors. How about that? And Ken said, Jack, we have degrees on rectal thermometers, and you know what we do with those. I didn't think you should be talking to a circuit court judge like that, but of course, what Ken was trying to explain to me is, in Alcoholics Anonymous, you can be too damn smart, and it'll kill you. I had to get out of the debating society. Ken and Bob were encouraging me to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'm not going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in Hagerstown. They suggested I go to Fellowship Hall, where my dad had been treasurer for like 10 years, but I'm not going out there with those people. You know, I'm responsible for their membership increase. I'm not going out there. Well, I'd go over to Martinsburg, West Virginia, which is just about a half hour, up to Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, over to Frederick, Maryland. I'd do that. But I'm not going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in Hagerstown. It ain't happening. And so Bob and Ken kept coming to my office, and we kept having these discussions. Bob and Ken knew something that I didn't know. And not only did they know something that I didn't know, they knew that I didn't know what it was that they knew that I didn't know. And they also knew if I knew that they knew something that I didn't know, knowing that they knew something that I didn't know and knowing that they knew it, I would have been really upset about that. But they were persistent and consistent in delivering the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to me. They didn't care whether or not I was going to be mad knowing that they knew something that I didn't know, because they wanted me to know what it was that they knew that I didn't know. And so over time, of course, I came to know what it was that they knew that I didn't know. And by that time, it really didn't matter to me to know that they knew something that I didn't know, because it didn't upset me to know that they knew that I didn't know. Because in AA, you know when you know that you know, and you don't know a moment before. Now, if you followed that, you're in the right place. And if you found it to be somewhat confusing, you're still in the right place. Just means you don't know. December 22nd was a Friday. It was a Friday before Christmas. The courthouse was closed. We couldn't have our big book study in my offices, so Ken and Bob and I went out to lunch. I was separated from my wife yet again. had an apartment after lunch. Ken and Bob went their ways, and I went back to my apartment. Up on the third floor, when I got there, there was a box propped against my door. It was a Hickory Farms package, one of these things you get at Christmas time with a cheese log or a sausage in it. I said, "This is nice. Somebody sent the judge a sausage. I'm going to have a little snack." I go into my apartment. I'm taking the messages off my answering machine. I'm trying to figure out how to get this package open. I see where the tape is. I got the keys out of my pocket. I slip the tape on the box. I'm listening to the message on the answering machine. I lift the lid of the box. Boom! Ten days before, a federal judge in Birmingham, Alabama, had been killed by an explosive device that had been sent to his home. And 5 days before, a lawyer in Savannah, Georgia, had been killed by a bomb that had been sent to his office. And I could smell the gunpowder, and I knew that I had opened a bomb. And there was a fire, and I couldn't put the fire out. And so I went into the hallway, out in the hallway, and I hooked the fire alarm, and a neighbor came and said he had a fire extinguisher, and I went back into my apartment, went back past the area where the fire was, and went to call 911, and when I went to push the buttons on the phone is when I first became aware that part of my right hand had been blown away. And I called 911, and they said, "Police, fire, or rescue," and I said, "I'd like to have one of each." And when I got finished with that phone call, I felt like somebody was pulling my pants off my hips. And I looked down, and I was standing in a puddle of blood. And it was just getting bigger and bigger as I looked at it. And my neighbor came and asked if he could do anything. And I asked him to get me a towel, and I opened my trousers, and I put the towel where I thought the injury was, and I didn't have the courage to look, and put my back against the wall, and I slid down on the floor. And it was pretty clear to me that I was going to die right there. I could feel life just draining out of me. And I was afraid. And I didn't know what to do. Die on that floor and never see our children again. And the only thing that I had learned in that time that I had been going to those meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd learned a serenity prayer. And so I asked God to grant me the serenity to accept this thing which I couldn't change, and the courage to change what I could, and wisdom to know the difference. And I prayed that prayer, and I prayed that prayer, and I prayed that prayer, and I prayed that prayer. And I can't tell you what was the fifth, sixth, or seventh time through that prayer, but I can tell you this. God came. And I experienced a sense of peace and well-being which I have never experienced before and have not experienced since. And I had no idea if I was going to live or if I was going to die on that floor. But I knew it was going to be all right. It'll be all right. And the police and the emergency people and the firemen all burst into my room and into my apartment, and they were trying to talk to me, and both of my eardrums had been blown out, and I really couldn't hear what they were saying. And as soon as I stopped praying a serenity prayer, this tremendous wave of fear swept upon me. And so I told them, "You guys go ahead and do what you have to do, and I'm going back to doing what I have to do." And as soon as I began to pray the serenity prayer, why, the serenity came back. And I just felt it was going to be all right. Even if I died there, it would be all right. So they cut all my clothes off of me, with the exception of my red and green Christmas socks. They carried me down three flights of steps. They pushed me in an ambulance. We have a little television station in Hagerstown. They took pictures of me going into the ambulance with my red and green socks. And that night, my red and green socks went around the world on CNN. And they took me to the hospital, and they prepared me for surgery, and they couldn't find my wife, and they couldn't find my girlfriend, but they found my sponsor, Ken. And they let him come back to where I was being prepared for surgery, and he held my hand. And he prayed for me and with me. And he stayed with me until they took me up to surgery. And I don't know how shrapnel knows to stop passing through flesh, but I can tell you this, that they found a piece of shrapnel not resting against, but in very close proximity to my femoral artery. And I think we all know if my femoral artery had been nicked, there'd be a different speaker here today. And they fixed up my right hand and they took me up to recovery. And I guess it was the second day I was, you know, coming in and out of consciousness. And I awakened, and there seated at the foot of my bed was my sponsor, Bob. He had a smile on his face. I should say here that it's really good to have a sponsor. It's good to have a sponsor because sponsors have a different take on things. They have a way of seeing things differently. And so there sat Bob at the foot of my bed with his smile on his face. And I said, "Bob, I see you're smiling. What are you smiling about?" "Oh, nothing much, Jack," he said. "I just think it must be wonderful." I said, "Wonderful, Bob? What do you mean, wonderful?" "Well," he said, "I just think it must be wonderful to know that you can't be harmed." "Somebody just tried to kill me, Bob. I'm not really following you." He said, "Well, Jack," he says, "as I understand it, that package you opened had four pipe bombs in it." He says, "One pipe bomb's more than adequate to kill a human being. Two pipe bombs is a little redundant. Three pipe bombs is around the bend. Four pipe bombs, Jack? You have really made somebody very angry." He said, I would say, Jack, that man has done his very best to kill you. And the only explanation of your survival is the grace of God." It's good to have a sponsor. I wouldn't have come up with that. No, never. Bob said, "God has work for you, Jack. You have been spared for a purpose." I said, "Really, Bob? And what kind of work does God have in mind for me?" He said, "I don't know. I don't know." He says, "I do know that it's God's will for you to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that means you're going to have to pray that third step prayer with either me or Ken, and you're going to have to do that fourth step inventory, and you're going to have to do that fifth step with either Ken or I, and you're going to have to do the sixth and the seventh step, make that eighth step list, get into those ninth step amends so you can live in 10, 11, and 12 and be of service to God and your fellow man." Good to have a sponsor. I wouldn't have come up with that one either. On Christmas Day of 1989, I was discharged from the hospital. It was the best Christmas I'd ever had. However, it was exceeded by Christmas of 1990, which is the Christmas that Ann and I reconciled. And we've been together ever since. And she serves as my lie detector, and I don't think she'll jump up on this one. I think I can say without fear of contradiction that our relationship is better today than it's ever been, and we owe that to a gracious God and the program of recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous. See, without the program of recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous, we separated three times while I was drinking and three times while I was not drinking. And since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, we haven't separated. I think that indicates that Alcoholics Anonymous works and that the power of God goes deep. Well, I now know that when I was reading that book with Bob and Ken and dropping in on those AA meetings, what I had is what I like to call cake mix recovery. And if we had a box of Duncan Hines Red Velvet cake mix up here this afternoon, I can assure you on the back of that package there is a three-step program to produce a red velvet cake. And I could read the back of that package to you, or I could pass it out into the audience, and you could pass it around and read it back to me and read it to each other. And I'm the kind of guy, after reading the three-step program on the back of that box, I'm looking for my red velvet cake. I have read the directions. Where the hell's my cake? And you see, I'm in my office reading a big book with Bob and Ken, and we're talking about it, and I'm looking around for recovery. And I got no recovery, and I got no red velvet cake. Because if you want cake, Jack, you got to open that box and get into action. You're going to have to break some eggs to make a red velvet cake. And if you want recovery, Jack, you're going to have to get into action. Not into thinking, into action. So I began to take action on the program of recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous. And things started happening for me. But you know, I got this thing about God. I don't want to have a relationship with this God that I parted company with when I was 14 years old. And Bob says to me, "Now, Jack, I understand your dad died with 15 years of continuous sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous." I said, "That's right, Bob." He said, "Now, how old were you when you prayed that prayer?" I said, "I was 14 years old." He said, "How old were you when your dad stopped drinking?" I said, "26 years old." He said, "12 years." I said, "That's right." He said, "Jack, do you know what 12 years means to infinite God?" Good to have a sponsor. Never thought about that. Bob said, 12 years, Jack, to infinite God is a nanosecond. It's an infinitesimal period of time. He said, "I'd say you got pretty quick service. What is your complaint?" How about that? Let me introduce you to my sponsor, Bob, who's been living in Tampa for the last 10 years. Bob, stand up.
Thank you. On behalf of my children and my wife, thank you.
In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says the problem for the alcoholic centers in the mind, that alcohol is but a symptom. There's something wrong with my mind. I've got an alcoholic mind. Simply how I think is my problem. S-H-I-T. Simply how I think is my problem. I have a thinking problem. I have an alcoholic mind. Nowhere in the big book do I read that it says anything about the alcoholic mind is removed. What I hear is, I've got an alcoholic mind. And what I've been given is a kit of spiritual tools that practices a way of life. Will remove not only the obsession to drink, and that is a good thing, but it will render the sufferer, and that's me, happily and usefully whole. And that's the thing I was searching for all my life. I just wanted to be happily and usefully whole. And I didn't know it. And I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I find the thing here that I've been searching for all my life. And I didn't know it was here. Bob and Ken knew it was here. I didn't know it was here. The longer I'm here, the less I do know. Now, here's something I do know. I'm here in Alcoholics Anonymous this afternoon because somebody prayed. My wife, my children, my mom. And my mom doesn't think I'm alcoholic. She just thinks I'm crazy. Somebody, please help my son. I also know that every single person in this room this afternoon who's alcoholic is here because somebody prayed. I don't care if you believe that or not. It doesn't make any difference to me. I know it is a fact. Probably a lot of somebody's prayed. You're not here by coincidence. There's something else I know. I know that this group of people assembled here this afternoon has never been assembled before in the history of the world. And we're never going to be assembled again. And in our big book it says, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Right here. Right now. If you're new here, stay here. There is nothing here that will harm you. Out there, you're likely to die. If you're just coming back, you know, you're not new, you're just used. That's okay. We start wherever we are. We just start wherever we are. If you're here and you've been here for a while and you're not happy, joyous, and free, get with your sponsor. Because we are absolutely guaranteed that we get to live happy, joyous, and free. That's not an idle statement in the big book. It says we absolutely insist on enjoying life. And we absolutely get to live happy, joyous, and free. I've got this pamphlet called A Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope every one of you are in possession of a copy of this pamphlet. If you're not, get one. Give it to your sponsees. Read it with your sponsees. I think it's the finest piece of literature that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous outside of the big book. That's just my opinion. You'll have to read it to see if you agree or not. But in the back of this pamphlet it says that this coming Sunday in the churches of many of us there will be read that portion of the Gospel of Matthew which recounts the time when John the Baptist was languishing in the prison of Herod. And hearing of the works of his cousin Jesus, he sent two of his disciples to say to him, Art thou he who is to come, or shall we look for another? And Christ did as he so often did. He did not answer them directly, but wanted John to decide for himself. And so he said to the disciples, Go and report to John what you have heard and what you have seen. The blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed. The deaf hear, the dead rise, the poor have the gospel preached to them. Back in my childhood catechism days, I was taught that the poor in this instance did not mean only the poor in a material sense, but also meant the poor in spirit. Those who burned with an inner hunger and an inner thirst, and that the word gospel meant quite literally the good news. Many years ago, two men, Ken and Bob, working singularly and together, maneuvered me into Alcoholics Anonymous. If they were to say to me, Jack, tell us what you found, I would have to say what I say to you now. I can tell you only what I have heard and seen. It seems the blind do see, the lame do walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise, and over again, in the middle of the longest day or the darkest night, the poor in spirit have the good news told to them. God grant that it may always be so. My name is Jack. I am an alcoholic. Thank you for letting me share.